Hey everyone, this is 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna, brought to you by the Believe Podcast Network, the number one podcast network for professionals. This episode, I'm joined by fellow St. Lawrence graduate and Stanley Cup champion general manager Ray Shiro. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe and rate on iTunes, Spotify, and all the streaming channels. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, at MikeMcKenna56. 6 Degrees fans, the Super Bowl is right around the corner. If you're looking to place a bet on any of the sports going on, BetOnline.ag is the best and only place to lock it in. I really like the Packers, but I'm rooting for the Bills. I would love to see Buffalo get a championship. That city deserves it. Such amazing sports fans. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than any place online. There's always the online casino. It never closes. So head to betonline.ag today and take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. Again, that's betonline.ag and sign up today. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. Support for 6 Degrees is also brought to you by Manscaped, the best in men's below-the-waist grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. I know it's one of those subjects that we don't talk about often, but I got to tell you, the Lawnmower 3.0, listen to this baby rev up. You know what's cool? It's got a light on it. It's not always easy to see what you're doing, but with the Lawnmower 3.0, you can't miss a spot. It's an unbelievable product. I can't imagine that anybody would have a loved one that wouldn't appreciate this thing. It's why the Manscaped team has redesigned the electric trimmer. The Manscaped engineering team spent 18 months, a year and a half, perfecting the greatest ball hair trimmer ever created and just released the new and improved Lawnmower 3.0. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code 6degrees at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. Use the code 6degrees. Try it. Guarantee you're going to like it. Thanks to all our sponsors for making this happen. Now we flip it over to Ray Shiro.
You have such a unique background. You know, I think if you just heard your name, you'd hear Ray Shiro. Okay, North American name. But, you know, you have a Canadian dad, French-Canadian mom, born in the USA, lived the hockey life moving around growing up. What was your childhood like?
That was really it, Mike. I'm great to join you this morning. My mom was born in Shawinigan and my dad was born in Winnipeg. And they met when my dad was coaching in Shawinigan and became player coach at the end of his career. And I was born in St. Paul, Minnesota. So it's my brother. But my real name is Ray Jean. That was for my mom and then my brother Jean-Paul. So, I only lived in Canada 5 years when I was with the Senators, 93 to 98. But from growing up and following my dad, it's kind of like being in the Army, I guess. But so from Minnesota to Buffalo to Omaha, Nebraska to Philadelphia to South Jersey to New York, no warm spots in there, but that was the hockey life. And, my dad got his first NHL opportunity in 1971 at the age of 46 after like 13 years in the minors as a coach. So, enjoyed a lot more. I was 9 years old when he first got his chance there. So I remember everything about that growing up. So I didn't mind moving. I don't remember packing any boxes or stuff like that. So my mom's probably still cursing me from her grave.
I remember moving. I remember packing boxes. I did a lot of that.
Oh, you must. Yeah, you must have them down pat.
Yep,
that's for sure.
U-Haul Tetris, what I'd like to call it. With all the experiences that you had, I mean, your dad was a legendary figure in hockey. Fred Shiro, 2 Stanley Cups with the Philadelphia Flyers and the Broad Street Bullies. He spent a lifetime in hockey and a very innovative coach. Did a lot of things that people hadn't thought about before. What did you learn from dad, the coach? What did you learn from dad, the dad?
My dad, I mean, growing up, my father, it was so funny. He was, even when he was the Flyers, he was there 7 years. And, learning from my dad was, he really wanted to go to law school. And he actually threatened, instead of going to the WHA back in like 74 after they won their first cup, they threatened to go to law school instead. That was a first. But he really, really pushed me and my brother up to school, academics and all that stuff. And, and pursue whatever you're passionate about. And mine was baseball. Mine was hockey. Tried to obviously keep my schoolwork. And that's what I push on my 2 boys now. One graduated from Boston College and one is at Connecticut College. But that's kind of got that from my dad. And from that, the coach, you know, I don't know if this was on purpose or not, but how I was, just like he was, I still remember when he was coaching the American Hockey League in Buffalo, the Buffalo Bisons. And I think I might've been in second grade or first grade or something like that. And I still remember almost every weekend we'd go over to Frankie Christie's house, and Frankie Christie was a longtime head trainer for the Bisons and Buffalo Sabres. And he just, I mean, had a great rapport with the people like that. Amazing. Frankie Christie around Philadelphia, Frank Lewis and Jimmy McKenzie, who I grew up around, and, you know, just, you know, Joe Cadillac in Philadelphia, really the first team of services guy. And, but what I, for my dad is, you know, in terms of the fabric of your team, fabric of the people that you have, he really was all about the players, all about the team, and all about his staff. Even if it was one trainer or two trainers, or there was no assistant coaches. He had the first assistant coach in NHL in 1972, but, you know, he was, you know, very passionate about the people, and it was them against, you know, the media, was them against the fans, except the fans of Philadelphia. And for me, I really saw that. And when I had my opportunity in Pittsburgh to be a GM for the first time, I really felt that fabric of your team. And you talk about culture all the time. And I mean, you really, everybody knows what culture says in the dictionary, but you really don't know what culture is until you can feel it. And a lot of that starts with your trainers, the support staff, and, you know, those role players and role people that are so important to anything and so important about having a team and having, you know, accountability is what you're doing. And that's what, you know, I really have loved being around the game is the people and people like that in particular.
Such a unique situation being around the Broad Street Bullies, I'd have to imagine, you know, a legendary group of people. I'm curious about the dynamic between a coach, a son, the players, what it was like in the 70s. You know, if you gravitated to certain players, if they reciprocated that love, if you're in the locker room and, you know, shooting pucks around, was there anyone that really took you under their wing and that you have fond memories of from that time?
Oh, yeah. I was in, my dad was 1971 to 1978 in Philadelphia. So 7 years, and I was 9 to 16 years old. So I remember almost everything. And I was one of those kids that always wanted to go to the ring with my dad. And fortunately, most of the time he'd bring me with him. And, but yeah, like being around those guys, and it's pretty funny because, you know, it's, you know, the Andre Duponts and Bobby Clarks and Rick McLeish's and the trainers that I mentioned, Jim McKenzie and Frank Lewis and, you know, Billy Barber. And, you know, it's funny, back then it was different. I mean, you know, back with Bernie Prant, you know, in 73-74, I mean, he played 73 of 78 games the 1 year, and then 74 of 78, I believe, the next year. And the backup goalie, you know, was Bobby Taylor. And he, you know, long time down in Tampa Bay doing the color commentary on TV, fantastic person. And it was weird. Like, Bernie used to come swing by the house and pick my dad up for practice sometimes. You don't really see that anymore. I don't think Marty's Bernard's picking up one of the coaches there, Jacques Lemaire, on the way to practice. But that was the way it was then. And it was so funny because, you know, Bernie played all the games and he was always playing. And, you know, it was, you know, they, Bernie, Bobby Taylor was, you know, of Indian descent. And after the first year, you know, his nickname was sitting, was the Chief, obviously. And then after only playing 4 of 78 games, the players changed his, the Flyer, the Broad Street Bullies changed his, you know, his nickname from Chief to Sitting Bull. So he knew exactly kind of where he was.
It's since reverted a great guy, back to Chief.
Yes, he got back to Chief for sure. The great guy. And no, but it was so funny because, you know, sometime I'd stay after and, you know, I was skate afterward. And I remember a few times Bernie was getting work done and Bernie would give me a ride home, or Bobby Clark gave us our first dog. And, you know, they had, you know, it's so different. You know, with Ed Snyder was the owner since day one, 1967, till he passed away, I believe it was in 2014 or 15, I think. But even when my father was inducted in the Hall of Fame in 2013, Ed Snyder, you know, chartered a plane and all the guys from the Broad Street Bullies in that era were there. And Hall of Fame, so they hadn't really ever seen that before. So that was such a tight group, and it was so great to be around it. Because, you know, Andre Dupont played for my father in Omaha when I was even younger. And it's so funny, when I first went to Ottawa in 93 as assistant GM, he was one of our scouts for a number of years, Andre Dupont. So it's kind of funny, and it was a great group to be around even as a kid.
When you win the Stanley Cup, or when the team wins the Stanley Cup, and your dad's a head coach of it, it's a little bit different in the 70s than it is now. They didn't parade the cup around all over the world. What were your memories of the celebration? Was it a one-day thing? Did it continue? Did you hug the cup? How did you get to treat it as the son of the coach?
Yeah, it was funny. I was in 74 and they won on home ice. And there was back then, there was no day with a cup and all that stuff. But there was a huge party back at the team bars, you know, at Rexy's. And it was an afternoon game too. But I remember that. I remember that vividly. And it was the next day when they had the parade and 2 million people showed up at the parade. And that was when we kind of had our pictures with the cup before the players got in their convertibles. And we were on, I think it was, in buses and stuff, the kids. And it was, that was back when there was 2 million people. I mean, it was incredible. It's insane. And, you know, that was, you know, going down Broad Street in Philadelphia, 2 million people. And, you know, we're 12 years old, 13 years old. And that was when streaking was in though too. So the problem was,
it was a cultural movement at the time.
Yeah, exactly. We're this huge bus and, you know, it's a flat nose. I'll never forget it. One of those bluebirds or something like that. And I was in the front seat, I remember, and, you know, the bus isn't even moving because there's so much, it's mayhem. I mean, up and down, it's crazy. And this guy, you know, he is butt naked, nothing on. He just jumps right on the front of the windshield of the bus, and he's hugging us saying, "Go Flyers." I'm like, what the heck? And I'm a little bus driver, I guess you've seen it before. It wasn't too phased. He just turned on his windshield wipers and flopped the guy right off the windshield. So I'm like, well, there's more where he came from. But yeah, it was pretty wild. And no, it was just, you know, when I was 12 years old then, and I remember everything about it, and that was awesome. But there was no Daves with the cup, unfortunately. They won it again the following year, this time in Buffalo, and then they had 2.3 million people, and needless to say, streaking was still in the next year too, so it was kind of crazy.
You mentioned the importance of academics to your father, and thinking about hockey at the time, you know, college hockey still wasn't the route that it is today to going to pro hockey, but you were a good hockey player. What made you end up at St. Lawrence? Why was that the right choice for you in your path at the time?
I wasn't exactly sure, to be honest with you. And it ended up being one of the best decisions I ever made in my life. But I went to prep school when I was 16 years old. My father, after his seventh year in Philadelphia, he actually went to the Rangers as GM coach. And I was going into my junior year of high school, and I hated the Rangers. And I didn't, that's, you know, I moved so much. And I know one thing, it's okay. It's easier, so much easier to move when you're younger. But you know, when you're 16 and, you know, you've been somewhere for 7 years and basically your formative years, those are all your friends. And I really hated the idea of junior year going to school somewhere in New York. And so a bunch of my buddies from Philadelphia that I played with, the little Flyers, I don't know, I never even heard of this prep school called New Hampton up in New Hampshire. And I was 16 years old. I ended up going there, and that changed my life. And I was there for 2 years. So I was 16, 17 years old. And they had a coach who was a first time coach at 24, 25 years old. His name was Joe Marsh. And he coached me for my first, you've heard of him, Joey Marsh. He was also my math teacher and one of the most influential people in my life. And he had taken over from really the guy that built New Hampton for 5 years before he went to Dartmouth for 2 years as assistant. They went to the Final Four with George Crowe, the head coach, Mike McShane. So my 2 years there at New Hampton were fantastic, but I didn't know anything about college hockey. I didn't know. And Mike McShane ended up, the spring of my senior year, ended up getting the head coaching job at St. Lawrence. And he ended up recruiting five or six of us. And we went up there, and all I remember is it was springtime, so it was really nice. And everybody could drink beer because the drinking age was 18. I'm like, well, this is great. I decided to go to St. Lawrence, and my 4 years were some of the best of my life, and some of my best friends in my life were from New Hampton and St. Lawrence. And I'm very fortunate at that opportunity, but it was really the Joe Marsh, Mike McShane connection. How I got, you know, timing's everything. And, you know, Mike, you know, yeah, after 2 years as assistant coach at Dartmouth, they did fantastic. And then he was just maybe 34 years old. He got the head job at St. Lawrence, and he spent 5 years there and really turned the program around. And Joey took it from there and for 25 more years.
Timing and relationships are everything, you know, and I think about my recruiting visit to St. Lawrence. I was recruited by Joe Marsh. He drove me from St. Lawrence to the airport in Ottawa in his pickup truck in the middle of the snow, you know, 6 foot of snow. It felt like, and I just remember I'm talking like this, you know, it felt like the right thing to do. It had that gut feeling. And anybody that comes across Joe Marsh has memories of him.
Joe, he's from Lynn, Massachusetts, actually. Went to UNH and played hockey there. But to me, he was, I think both the years I was there, he got Teacher of the Year. He was a math teacher. He was so smart. And I was in his math classes. And, you know, I think it was in my first semester at New Hampton. And there's only about 8 kids in the class, right? And I think it was November, December, something like that. And we just started getting on the ice, but it was snowing. And I mean, I'll never forget this kid, Drew Segarelli. I don't think Joe liked his attitude. So Joe went across the classroom at New Hampton, grabbed him by the scruff of the shirt and the belt buckle and opened the window and threw him up the window. And I don't think you can do this these days. And fortunately, we're on the second floor. Joe to this day says the first floor. Regardless, there was a snowbank the kid dropped into, Drew, which the headmaster was just happened to be giving a tour to prospective students' parents at the same time. So I can't confirm that the kid actually ended up going to New Hampton when the body fell out of the second floor window. But that was Joe, and Joe was he was also my dorm master. I mean, there was only 9 kids in our dorm. It was right next to the hockey rink in New Hampton, which is, I had no idea when I went there that the rink was totally outside. There was no sides, no roof. And as you can imagine, it gets pretty cold up in New Hampshire. And but Joe was fantastic. And that's where I first met. They were started a date was Teddy, his wife. And so I go way back with Joe, and he was especially my first year. That's exactly what I needed. He was, he was so hard on me, and I don't think he thought he was hard on me at all. I thought he did, but it was the best thing ever happened to me, and which I needed in my life. And I go back the next year, I'm like, oh boy, I mean, I was the youngest kid by far on the team. I was 16. I mean, we had PGs, a bunch of them were 19, and I was in the fifth line. And I said to Joe years later, Joe, I didn't even know there were 5 lines in hockey. Fifth line, I mean, when it's like 20 below out, that's not fun. And the next year, I had no idea what to expect. And I don't know, until the first game, and I'm on the first line. So that year went real well. And that's really how I got to St. Lawrence. But some great life lessons at New Hampton, and great memories of Joe Marsh. No different than Mike McShane. And same thing with Brett Brackey, the new coach of St. Lawrence now. He reminds me that they're all the same in terms of great hockey people, but better, I mean, people that will impact your life in a great way and in a lasting way. And they've really passed it on to so many different people. And I'm sure including yourself, Mike, and your teammates, and they care about you. And I'm still very good friends with Joe and Mike McShane, and see them quite a bit, which is great. And, so that's, if someone can capture that, a hockey environment, a hockey experience, along with educationally and socially, like we had at St. Lawrence, that's something special. And I was very fortunate.
You've had a lot of people stay in your life, as you mentioned. Randy Sexton's one of those people, a teammate, a coach, mm-hmm. and then a boss, and
yes.
you finished your career at St. Lawrence. You put up a ton of points, you're drafted, but you don't end up going to play professional hockey.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose to go into being a player agent? Was there any thought of maybe law school or some other way to advance your schooling, or were you determined to remain in hockey in some way?
Yeah, that's really it, Mike. I think when I was drafted by Los Angeles after my sophomore year, but it was really funny. I was supposed to be drafted maybe after my first year, my freshman year. And I wasn't. And that summer I was at the Olympic Festival in Colorado Springs in July, and after my freshman year. And I ended up tearing up my knee, ACL, MCL. But I missed my entire sophomore year at St. Lawrence. And then, believe it or not, that summer, after my sophomore year, which I didn't even play, I got drafted by LA. And so then I came back my junior, senior year and had 2 good years. And, I had offered them like a 3-way contract, went to camp without one of them. It was a great experience. Pat Quinn was a coach. And Pat Quinn, actually, my father hired him, gave him his first coaching job back in Philadelphia as his assistant in 76 or 7, I believe. Incredible man. And it was a great experience. At the same time, once training camp ended and, they'll send me to Toledo because they were splitting New Haven, their AHL team, with the Rangers. And I was a center. Each team has 2 centers. Well, after a month of training camp, remember I said to my dad, what do you think I should do? And he said, well, didn't really put you through St. Lawrence to play in Toledo. But again, he said, well, you do whatever you want. I'll support you 100%. My mom was the same way. I said, yeah, you know what? Actually, I decided, and I remember probably it was about four to six months. Because I interviewed at Wall Street. All of my buddies from St. Lawrence are on Wall Street.
I think we all did. You know, I interned for 3 years. And
right, right. Well, of course, every company that I went to is like Elliott Rothschild, Kidder Peabody, and Bear Stearns. Of course, they all went kaput. So fortunately, I think it was the next spring of 86 is when I moved to Boston and got in the agent business. I was like 23 or 4, and I did that for 6 years, but I was in the real estate business, and I was young, and it was the best time ever. I lived in Boston, you know, basically out of St. Lawrence for 6 years, and that's where I live now, and that's always been kind of home, and for my kids as well. So that's been fantastic. My wife's from Boston as well, and but it's, you know, it's one of those, you know, experiences that, you know, even with Randy, I mean, he comes in, he was a junior, I was a freshman, but right away, I mean, I could tell, I mean, he had incredible leadership qualities in him. You saw him, and you wanted to follow him. And I was very fortunate to have him kind of be my mentor along my couple of years there. And of course, Randy went on from there to get his MBA at Clarkson and also coach at St. Lawrence and did a fantastic job. And certainly going on from there to becoming one of the founders of the Ottawa Senators and general manager and president. And that's how I got into pro hockey.
When you got that call from Randy and he said, "Hey, we need some folks for the Ottawa Senators. We were teammates. I was your coach." Were you nervous about that opportunity? I mean, obviously you must've had a friendship that made you comfortable, but that's a pretty big step, you know, to go from doing your agency business to going into the deep end in management.
Yeah. And it was, you know, that was after the Senators' first year, 92-93, and he was the president that year. And then they made a move, and then, you know, fired Mel Bridgen, who was the GM. And so Randy became president and GM. But I think, you know, Randy's a smart guy, and you know, if he's that smart, he probably not hired me. But he was, you know, having 6 years, he was looking for someone. Like, we always kept in touch, and you know, and because I was in the business, negotiating contracts, you had those are the things I really learned from the Asian business. And back then, the money obviously was not even a quarter of what it is now. And I did it because I wanted to stay in the game, and if I could have maybe gotten a scouting job, I would have been scouting or something like that. So that, you know, back then you're, you know, meeting so many different people in the game and contacts and seeing so many games and negotiating contracts, learning about the CBA. And after 6 years, I mean, I was excited about the opportunity big time. And, you know, it was a big move to Canada, and we didn't have any kids at the time, but I was excited about it. And I was, you know, Randy was fantastic to me. So it was, you know, and then I worked with Randy maybe two and a half years, 3 years. Something. And then when he got let go by Ottawa, I mean, Pierre Gauthier came in, and he was fortunate to keep me, and I was lucky, and Randy really encouraged me to stay. So, you know, fast forward how things work, and obviously we have remained really, really good friends. And when I had the opportunity, not just because out of friendship or because I thought I owed, like, I ended up hiring him in Pittsburgh when I was a GM there, and Randy ended up staying there. I'd worked with Randy for at least a couple of years, 3 years, and then when I got let go after 8 years in Pittsburgh, he stayed on and won a couple Stanley Cups there with him. And then went to Buffalo, and now is with Minnesota. So he did a lot for me, put it that way.
They weren't easy years in Ottawa. I talked to Randy the other day, and he said that he looked at you at one point and he goes, "Man, that's a rough schedule, Ray. There's no easy nights." And you fired right back at him. You said, "Hey buddy, we're the easy nights."
Yeah, that was exactly it, man. I was there the second year. I mean, honest to God, it was a great time though. Like, I look back and, you know, certainly we were all so young then. But our, you know, head coach is Rick Bonus, and one of the nicest people in hockey is, you know, Mike. And it's so nice to see him do so well for himself in Dallas. And, but also Alain Vigneault, the head coach of Philadelphia, longtime coach now, but Alain was just in his first, second year of assistant coaching. E.J. McGuire's there. We had John Ferguson.
There was a
Ferguson,
ton of young
senior
talent. Like, coaching and management.
Oh, Jimmy Neal was there. Yeah. No. Chalpice, we had it. You know, we're
in an all-star club. Yarmo Kekäläinen was there at some point, too.
I hired Yarmo. I was Yarmo's agent, for God's sakes. I hired Yarmo. And for a Clarkson guy, I mean, it had to be pretty good. But, no, Trevor Timmons, you know, obviously assistant GM in Montreal. And but so many really good people. And, you know, Paul Castro, obviously, another St. Lawrence guy. And but that was – but that was fun. And, you know, what we didn't know, I mean, I still remember, I mean, St. Louis would come in at the old Civic Center, beat us 11-0, Dallas, you know, 10-1. And we just thought we were a player or two away. Boy, it took time, and but it was amazing that how they even got the team there. Randy Sexton, Schroeder, and Bruce Firestone, and you know, it was pretty amazing. And then you know, obviously the building that got built there, and but it was a great learning experience. And yeah, we, you know, it was as a, you know, I was assistant GM. You know, it was my first year assistant GM, 93-94, and I did that 5 years in Ottawa and 8 years in Nashville, so 13 years. And you know, the assistant GM role, I always say the best gig in hockey, assistant GM. I remember at the old Civic Center, we were getting, it was a couple weeks before Randy got fired, I believe, midway through the 95-96 season. And we're playing someone in that little barn, and the fans are chanting. And we had this, we sat in this little box over center ice or by the blue line. And me and Randy was tiny, and Randy would basically come so close, like toss, just throwing like water bottles and stuff on the ice. You had to hold them back like 3-4 times. And anyway, he was, the fans just start chanting, Sexton must go, Sexton must go. And Randy leans over to me and said, Ray, what the hell are they saying? I mean, I said to him, well, Randy, they're not saying Shiro must go. I mean, that was just a gem. If you can get that gig, it's the best one going. So we got, years later, we got a chuckle out of that one.
It feels kind of similar to being a goaltender, really. If you're the GM, you're the goaltender. Oh. You can't hide. Like, think about being a third or fourth line forward. You can just float around out there, get a couple shifts, get a couple hits, maybe chip in 10 or 15 points. Nobody's calling for your head. You know, there's so much pressure that goes into it. Did you learn more as an agent or as an assistant GM that prepared you for being a general manager?
I think all of it, Mike, seriously, because I think a lot of it is dealing with people. And I think that's a lot of the role of the general manager. And if I gave you a business card of when I was a GM, they give you like 500, you always end up with 499 of them. But what you do, everything say you make trades, you have signings, that's what a GM does. How great. Well, that's like 10% of your job. And really it's, you're a manager of people. That's what you are. You manage your ownership, your media, your, the agents, the players, the trainers, your scouts, your, you know, that's what you're doing and managing. And if, you know, I learned a lot, you know, in terms of, I guess, that communication from the 6 years in the agent business, certainly 13 years, you know, from a AGM standpoint, between, you know, working for Randy Sexton as a GM, Pierre Gauthier, of course, David Poile, and, you know, everybody has their different styles. And, but I learned, I mean, you try to continue evolving, obviously, and even back then, and you know, those were the simpler days probably, but I think you take a lot from, you know, because it's, you know, it's about relationships too. And I really, along the way, I think it's all of it has really helped me and, you know, prepare me. And when I finally got that opportunity in 2006, and even after 13 years as assistant GM, I mean, remember in 2006-07, my first year as GM of the Penguins, and we were driving to the first game against Philadelphia at home. And I think it was that the Fray had the song Cable Car in over my head. That was playing. I'm like, that's me. I have no idea what I'm doing. Because you don't know until you don't know, and you get there. And, you know, as Bobby Clark said, long when he first got the GM job in 85 in Philadelphia, sometime I'm just flying by the seat of my pants. So, but it was, you know, all that really added up to, you know, helping me, you know, not just get a chance to be a general manager, but have some success doing it, obviously. And I think a lot of that's, you know, has benefited me by working with those different people along the way.
Last year was the first time I ever heard the phrase that you have to manage up. I'd never heard that before. I'm sure it's out there in some managerial book or something that I haven't read, but it really struck me, you know, that it's, you're not just managing the people below you. Did you find it, or do you find it more difficult to manage players or owners?
Well, I think it's more, I think it's more important to manage owners, and you know how important it is to manage players. And part of that, you're managing the players with, let's say, your coaching staff, your assistant GM, whatever that is, your development guys, sometime with the agent, along with the player. But I think everything else, I mean, managing up, or back in the day, maybe sucking up, I don't know. But managing up is, it's not even a bad, the connotation not even that bad, because really the owners, they own the team. And, you know, I think it's really important, because, you know, you go through an interview process and everything is fantastic if you get offered the job because you appear to be on the same page. But as you know, like, you know, as soon as the bumps start hitting the road, and you know, especially now over the last 10 years or whatever it's going to be with, you know, social media and Twitter and things like that. Well, they're competitive people, and the more you can keep them informed and make sure and explain to them or give them heads up, because the worst thing you find with, you know, with anything ownership is surprises. They just don't want to be surprised. And that's what happened. Well, that's not good. So managing up is more the flow of information. And listen, we talked about this, and you know, but if we do this, it's going to kind of, that's not exactly the plan we set out, but sometimes there's a different trajectory for your team. You know, like it was in Pittsburgh, we made a big trade to, I think, my second year for Marion Hossa and things like that. It, you know, I remember saying to Mario Lemieux, it's like, Mario, this is a risk. And it was, you know, 2 minutes to the deadline, and it was a huge deal. And you know, it's not what we had talked about. It more of a 5-year plan. We're only in year two. And, but the team had done a lot better than anticipated, I guess. And Mario, that's what you need support from someone like Mario. Said, right, you run the hockey operation. I don't know the players that well. But everything you described, it's like 1 minute before the deadline. Mario's on the golf course and just said, right, I bought this team in a bankruptcy. I'm a risk taker. If you want to do it, I support it. If you don't, I totally understand, but don't worry about 5-year this, 5-year that. And I think he had to go because he had a tee shot to take, but that's what, I mean, it's incredible, but you know, that was part of the communication and managing up type of stuff. And I think, and that's one of those things too, Mike, I think it's easier said than done sometimes.
It's not an easy conversation, I'm sure, at times.
No, I mean, of course not. And you know, it's, you know, what people don't see as to how things happen or, you know, someone gets traded or someone doesn't get traded, or, you know, if a player gets traded from Boston to Chicago, well, maybe there's an owner in Detroit asking, what the hell happened? I thought we were going to get that guy. Well, that is, I mean, the communication part is of that managing up is really important, and things do fall through the cracks, but, you know, through a lot of texting and so forth, and, you know, obviously board meetings and things like that, but it's become a much bigger job managing that. But that's all part of it. And that's why managing down as well in terms of delegating, I always appreciate that the assistant GM, because it's more for that person to do and allocate things and delegate. So they get experience as well, like I did. And, but again, it's one of those things you really have to, you know, keep in mind the biggest thing is, just with the ownership. And I think that's a big part of the manager's job, and certainly one that I took seriously, and I think everybody does, and just making sure, and obviously in sync with them and what the team's doing and what you're thinking. And so there are no surprises.
About midway through your career, you head to Nashville, another expansion team. I'd look at this from the outside and go, this guy's, he's a glutton for punishment. You know, he's self-flagellating, you know, like what made that an attractive option at that stage of your career?
Well, it was funny because that was, I was in my fifth year in Ottawa as assistant GM, and I think it was November. And it was, I think it was on my third year where we made the playoffs the first time. You know, Pierre Gauthier was a GM and Jacques Martin, St. Lawrence guy. Jacques was our head coach, and they both did fantastic jobs. And so we made the playoffs in 96 and 97. And then into my fifth year, the only it was really a lateral move, but you know, David Poile was the new GM of the expansion team in Nashville, and he had been, you know, for 15 years a GM in Washington, and I really didn't know David that well, and it wasn't like assistant GMs are traveling the same circles as GMs. And he, you know, Pierre Gauthier came to my office one day and just said, you know, Pierre Gauthier has asked permission to talk to you about the assistant GM job there, assistant GM job in Nashville. And I went down there and talked to him, met with him for like 3 days. And my attraction expansion, I'd been through it, obviously, with Ottawa, but a lot of it was really working with David Poile. I mean, he was, now he's the winningest GM in hockey history, but also to me, to be able to learn from him. And he never had an assistant GM before in his 15 years in Washington, so it was his first one. And that was, ended up being a great move for me, 8 years in Nashville working for David. And, I never worked a day in my life as assistant GM, let alone my years with David to be a GM. I was just passionate about being in the game and never wanted to let my boss down. And in this case, it was David or Pierre Gauthier, Randy Saxon, whoever it was. And that's really why I probably got an agent, was passionate about the game and want to be involved. And again, it's always pass it on to the guys that, listen, you know, in terms of ambition, is everybody's got ambition, but that's sometimes dangerous as well. And again, I think I did a good job balancing that, because, you know, even when the opportunity came for me in 2006 after 13 years, I mean, it wasn't something that, you know, if I didn't get the Pittsburgh job or any GM job, I hopefully I'd still be in Nashville enjoying myself right for David. So, but again, that opportunity came along and I never chased it though. But I think it was one of those things that going 8 years to work with David, that decision in 98, I think paid off for me. And, you know, I was happy I did it.
Whole lot more with Ray Shiro to come. But sports fans, with a new year comes tons of new big games in sports. With big games, you need big stakes. Kansas City Steaks has the cuts you crave to celebrate the playoffs and the big game. Visit kansascitysteaks.com/gameday and save up to $25 on combos perfect for game day. Plus, get free shipping with code BELIEVE, B-L-E-A-V, at checkout. Try out the snack pack combo featuring small plates with big flavor, mini beef Wellington steak burger sliders, mac and cheese melts, shrimp wrapped in bacon. Every order is flash frozen, delivered directly to your home. Satisfaction guaranteed or your money back. Basically every cut of steak imaginable, plus appetizers, desserts, barbecue, and so much more. Again, go to kansascitysteaks.com/gameday. Use the code BELIEVE, B-L-E-A-V, at checkout for free shipping. Kansas City Steaks, big games, big taste. And don't forget about longtime friend of the show, Skin Effects Wraps. The best way to get your helmet looking good, get a new design on it, get rid of that old style, get the new style. Hit up Skin Effects Wraps on Instagram. Mark Magnanti is the guy in charge of it from Rochester, New York, great American company. He can make your dreams come true when it comes to helmet design. It's an affordable way. It's a quick way. It looks fantastic. My mask is currently wrapped in a Vegas Golden Knights theme. You cannot tell that it used to be something else. So if you need your mask done in a hurry, in an affordable way, visit Skin Effects Wraps on Instagram. And if you're a goaltender looking to improve your game, I'm available for coaching through 44visionhockey.com. You go on, you create an account, and you put my name in as your coach. I'll take all your video from Live Barn, from Hockey TV. We upload those, take all the clips, and then we go through it all in a Zoom meeting. You get a couple of clips that you get to refer back to that'll be on your player page at all times. I take what I know of the position, what I've learned from all the goalie coaches that I've worked with, put it into your game through a pro's eye. So go to 44visionhockey.com. Again, put me in as your coach. I'd love to work with you. And now, more with Ray Shiro.
On a personal level for us, we have so many parallels and so many ties. You know, Joe Marsh recruits you to St. Lawrence. Joe Marsh recruits me to St. Lawrence. You're in Nashville. I'm drafted by Nashville. I do four development.
Was it sixth round? What round?
Sixth round, 172nd overall, 2002 draft. And changed my life, getting the chance to work with Mitch Korn and see the insides of an NHL franchise. And that organization at the time, I remember looking back at some of these pictures and the defensive core that we had, Suter, Hamhuis, Weber, Klein. I mean, this is tip of the iceberg stuff. And we're Upshaw too. There was so much young talent and the team had drafted so well. I was disappointed I didn't get a chance to be part of that. And that's really my question, Ray, is why on earth would you guys sign Pekka Rinne and not Mike McKenna at the time in 2005 when I was coming off a hot college career and a young prospect and ready to go?
Well, especially, I mean, you were a sixth round pick and Pekka was an eighth round pick.
Yeah.
And that's it's so funny though, all those guys you just mentioned too, Mike. I mean, you know, from, you know, Shea Weber and Suter and Hamhuis and all those guys I had in Milwaukee. I was running Milwaukee at the same time, the AHL team. And imagine that. I mean,
Siegel's another name. I was on five teams with him.
Brandon, of course. Yeah, Brandon. Bernd Fiedler. I mean, they win the Calder Cup in 04. Claude Noel was our coach. You know, that was some amazing guys. And it's so funny, but the Pekka Rinne thing, and, you know, it's amazing that Pekka, you know, is the longest tenured Predator. I'm sure they'll retire his jersey when he's done. And but he was drafted in 04, the draft in Hartford in the eighth round. And it was really actually Jarmo Kekäläinen's brother, Jani, who I'd hired probably two or three years earlier to scout for us over in Finland. And I mean, it was so funny because, you know, he really, really liked Pekka Rinne, and no one even heard of the guy. He's like, while you're over here, Ray, I was at a tournament in Helsinki. He goes, we got to fly up. You got to see this kid. I mean, but you got to watch him warm up. Why? Because we fly to, you know, up to Oulu. and in February. So we go up there and got a watchman warm up because he never plays. Well, how good can he be? He's like, Ray, I just think this kid's going to be good, and he's huge. Okay, so watch warm up, and I still remember I couldn't wait for the flight back that night because it was like 35 below in Oahu, and I'm watching. And all of a sudden, after warm up, I watch him warm up, and Yanni K. Glenn turns to his Ray, what do you think? I'm like, of the goalie? I'm like, listen, if he played the game, Yanni, I couldn't even probably tell you, but if you like him, you know, it's just tell Paul Fenton about him. Paul was, you know, running the draft, and sure enough, eighth round, and he only maybe played 6-7 games or whatever it was, because he played behind some guy, which I'm like, who the heck's this guy then? It was Nicholas Backstrom, who ended up going to play for Minnesota Wild, you know, for a long time, and was a great goalie. But once he left, then Pekka took over. But it was funny because Pekka spent 3 years in Milwaukee in the American League.
Yep.
And I remember seeing Pekka a few years ago at the World Championships, and he had recently signed this $7 million deal with Nashville. He was so funny because I said, Pekka, do you remember the first contract we bid? Because he came over and yep. I go, what was your signing bonus? And he remember, it was like, I think he said $9,600. That was a signing bonus.
Yep.
I go, yep. That was, and honestly, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. But it took him a lot of time. But realistically, I will have to say, upon further reflection, Mike, that's one we got right. Okay. Yeah, versus, well, you had a great career, Mike, but Pekka, you know, it's not all right.
Well, you uncovered a real hidden gem. I mean, that's the point. That's the moral of this, is that you have to be willing to think outside the box at times when you're drafting. You know, you hit a home run in the seventh or eighth round, that's where you find your real value down the road.
Absolutely. It goes to, it's so different. I was saying in terms of, you know, from being a GM, like let's say David Poile in that case, in terms of delegating, and you can't have your hands on, even Paul Fenton's like, when the eighth round, Leon, if you want to take him, go ahead. But that's, you know, having trust in your staff and really empowering to do their job. And certainly, you know, Yanni Kekalainen along with Lucas Bergman have done an amazing job since day one. They're still there running the European side for the Nashville. And they've gotten so many good players there and later round guys. And that's the way, obviously, you have to hit on those guys as well. But that was a good story. And you have to say, like, with everything, you get someone lucky.
It's funny that Pekka and I have stayed friends over the years. It's not like we text each other or anything, but you know, we were in the development camps together, and I had a brief stint in Milwaukee just as a call up on a PTO. And I remember being stuck there over Christmas, and they said, well, we want to call you up, but you're going to be there for Christmas. And I was like, absolutely. I'll do anything. You got it. And sure enough, Rich Peverly, also St. Lawrence graduate and teammate for 3 years, myself and Pekka Rinne all had Christmas together, you know, and then I think it had been a decade since we'd seen one another, and I'm warming up for, I think it was with Ottawa or Dallas. I can't remember which team I was with at the time, but seeing each other at the red line, you know, and just huge smiles. Here we are 15 years down the road from being drafted at least. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Pekka's got probably 70 sheets in the bank, and I don't have anything close to that, but it's still that mutual friendship, that winking, yeah. Like, hey man, we're still here. We're still doing it. It's special, you know?
That's great. Let's see where both you, honestly, where Pekka came from, or, you know, his draft, or you, I mean, your careers, everybody, no one has a parallel path. That's for sure. And your career is as interesting as anybody's, and the match to the people that you've met along the way have you bettered their life or vice versa. But guys like that. And even like Rich Peverly, as you mentioned, St. Lawrence guy. And I still remember how Claude Noel, who coached Winnipeg Jets and also, you know, coach Milwaukee, the Calder Cup, and Claude, you know, still a good friend, and he scouted pro scouting for New Jersey. And we talked about that quite a bit. Richie Peverly ended up, we got him out of the East Coast League. It was during the actual lockout, I think 2004, 2005 or whatever. And Claude always, because I said, this, I'm telling you, Peverly, we had really no farm team in the East Coast, anything like that. We just get guys here and there from Milwaukee. We're kind of going back and forth, and because I guess I was running the team, the assistant GM in Nashville, I guess I got Rich Peverly, and he wanted Marco Rosa. And so we ended up giving Richard the opportunity, and certainly did fantastic with it. And it was so funny because he ends up obviously, you know, becoming an NHL player first with Nashville, but I never forget when I think it was Pittsburgh, we're playing in Nashville, and I saw Richie after the game, and Barry Trotz, who was a fantastic person and coach, but Barry's the coach in Nashville, and he wasn't in the lineup. And I saw Richie after the game. He goes, "Ray, I don't know what's going on. I think I might be out of here." Sure enough, the next day he's on waivers, and Atlanta, I think, was first in Atlanta, claimed him. And that was, he was disappointed, but man, oh man, did that ever work out well for Richie Pefferly and Atlanta Thrashers, and played so well there and became an NHL player. And then, you know, the big trade to Boston, wins the Stanley Cup, and a really key player of that cup team for the Bruins. And again, it's great to see him still in hockey with Dallas, and he's a great guy, as you know, Richie
Pefferly. I think Pevs has a really, really bright future in hockey. I truly believe that. When we played together, he knew every player in the National Hockey League when we were at college, knew the game incredibly well, great personality. I could see him in a higher management role down the road for sure. To me, he was always a victim of the 04-05 lockout in terms of coming out of school. He was our best player at St. Lawrence for 3 years, arguably four, led the team in scoring. I think he's the type of guy who would have easily been in the American League had it not been for the lockout that year. That team, the American League, was absolutely stacked in 04-05. Stacked.
Absolutely. That was like, oh boy, that was really amazing. And that was, but actually, it was fortunate for me because I happened to be, I think we're done in Florida because it was during the lockout. I don't know if I was done at David Poyle's place or maybe at meetings that I can't remember, but I remember we went to, I think, when Estrell went to see the game there. And actually, we're going to see, I think he was, maybe in part of the Predators, maybe Shane Knighty was playing. And
who now I'm on the broadcast team with in Vegas.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, of course.
Six degrees, Shane, right?
He was, there you go. Isn't that funny? But it was, I think it was Mighty Guns. And next thing I'm like, hey, Richie Pefferly's playing. Sure enough, he played great. And we needed a call up, you know, during the American League that season. And sure enough, he got his chance on the PTO to go to Milwaukee. And, you know, the rest he kind of wrote himself, obviously, and it's great to see him involved in the game. He's a wonderful guy, and it's a small world, though, and who you might see. So if he was playing in, like, Manitoba, I could say Manitoba because, you know, my dad's from Winnipeg, and I got relatives there. But if Richie was playing on in the East Coast League in Manitoba, I'm not sure I would have saw him there. But Florida, I was on it. I was on the case.
So we'll take that flight. You got the gig in Pittsburgh. You show up and you said you didn't know what you were doing, but you had some nice pieces. Somebody named Crosby, another guy named Malkin, a goaltender named Fleury. It's easy to look at that team and go, oh, they had all these superstars. No wonder they won the cup. That's never the case. I look at a team like Edmonton right now that's had Connor McDavid for six seasons, and they haven't been able to find the mojo or the success. And that's a generational talent. So when you're building that team in Pittsburgh, you talk about the trade, I believe you said, for Gabrick or Hossa.
Marian.
You end up ahead of the curve. You start taking swings. What were the pieces of the puzzle that led to that 09 cup?
I think my first year was 06, 07. That was Crosby's second year. And that was probably a great thing for me because, you know, that was Malkin's first year. It was my first year. He came over. But it was, I think I benefited for Sid playing the previous year, his rookie year. He had 102 points as a rookie, 18 years old. Unfortunately, the team had 58 points. And
it's not the right ratio.
You know, Craig Patrick did. No, it's not. And but and Craig Patrick, I mean, did a fantastic job there for 15 years. And but at the end, I mean, with Pittsburgh, they just didn't have the money. And that really forced us, and it was difficult. But when I came in, you know, Sid, he experienced it. I think it was really beneficial to experience that versus, you know, Gino came in, and since Gino's been there, teams never missed the playoffs or anything like that. But I think to me, I kind of go back to, you know, looking at that team and really not, you know, we didn't have a lot of money at the time. We were just 06, 07, still playing at Mellon Arena and, you know, weren't going to make any big free agent signings, but I still remember, you know, the type of people we wanted. And, you know, in the locker room, at the old Mellon Arena in the locker room now, where the Penguins are, that, you know, it's the same three words. It's still up there: passion, accountability, workout. That's what I wanted to establish, not only in players and as a team, but that's what the three things I really looked for when I wanted to, you know, talk about hiring trainers or scouts. Or you have to have a passion for what you're doing. There's an accountability and certainly a work ethic. Those three things are so different from a team aspect or what's really big is a team off the ice, which, you know, Pittsburgh became. And You know, same things where there's a Crisco pedal in New Jersey, the head equipment guy with Dana Heinze in Pittsburgh. Them and their staff really helped create a culture one way or the other of how things go. And but I think, you know, right off the bat, there was no, with no money. So it was signed Mark Eaton as a free agent on defense, a 2-year deal, Jarkko Ruutu, a 2-year deal, trade for Dominic Moore, guys like this that, you know, kind of rounded out. We just wanted to, and Michael Terry and I didn't know him as a coach, and ended up, you know, with Michael, I think for 2.5 years, and he did a, we ended up having a really good relationship, and he was a great person to work for as a manager. He always had my back and vice versa. And, but I think it was really those building smaller things. And Pittsburgh already had guys like, you know, Joe Malachar, Rob Scuderi, Michelle Ouellette we had brought back. You know, it was just Max Talbot, bringing, you know, Talbot up during the season. It was, you know, Jordan Stahl. It was, you know, his first year, was 18 years old, scored 29 goals. A lot of it really came together. And, you know, we ended up, had 105 points my first year. And, you know, it, I think that was really establishing something, and the accountability off the ice and the culture there, which, you know, it had to do with how you travel, had to do with your expectations of yourself as a group and how you do things. And, you know, I'm really happy all the people, I'd have to say 90% of the people that I hired in my years in Pittsburgh are still there, unless they've, you know, really moved on for GM jobs or coaching jobs or whatever the case is. So hopefully that'll be the same case in New Jersey, where there's good people in place and, you know, they can do a good job over time.
When you saw Fleury make that last save, 1.8 seconds left to win the Stanley Cup, you're following your dad's footsteps. What's going through your head? Because you've got history with it. It's not like this is somebody mm-hmm. who's coming from the outside who's never experienced this before. You have, at least in some capacity. Did you have thoughts flood of your dad in the past success, or how do you quantify a Stanley Cup win that's been on your terms?
We had lost to Detroit the year before in the finals in 6 games, and you know, we, the next year, I mean, those Detroit teams were so good. I mean, their defense, I mean, you know, Lidstrom and Rafalski and Brad Stewart, they were so good and up front. I mean, Zetterberg, Datsyuk, Clear, they had role players, they had speed, they had the best 6 defensemen, and they were good. And, you know, to get the game 7, you know, to get the last, you know, face off of the game, which everybody sees Fleury making that save, but like the first save was through traffic. I mean, yep.
Mitch Korn calls that the greatest save in hockey history.
Really?
Yep.
I mean, he didn't get the second one, as he stops the first one, which is good. That was a Falsky shot, I think. And then of course Lidstrom came in, and I mean, that is, you know, the face-off everybody sees, but honestly, God, there were 16 seconds left. The face-off was outside the zone, and they still had 2 chances there. They must have had 4 chances in the last 16 seconds. Of course, the 2, you know, off that face-off, but that was, you know, it was really amazing. You couldn't have written a better script in terms of the team you lose to the year before. You know, we had traded for Marian Hossa at the deadline, and Marian, Hall of Fame player now, and I had him in Ottawa as a young player, and incredible person. Well, you know, he didn't resign with us. We offered him, I think in Pittsburgh, offered him 5 years, $7 million a year to stay. And I remember getting a call from him on July 1st saying, I don't think I can continue with the Penguins. And, you know, I want to win a Stanley Cup, and I'm picking a team I think I might have a better chance. And that team was Detroit. He signed a 1-year deal. Again, so I mean, I give him a lot of credit because he turned down $35 million deal for, I think, $7 million to Detroit. You know, you look at that team, yeah, they just beat us, and you add him. Yeah, probably had a bad bet on Marion's part. So turns around, we end up beating them in game 7. And I think in the series, Marion, I don't know if he had more than a point or two, something like that. But as hockey god should be, is, you know, that made him 0-2 in the finals. And it couldn't happen to a better guy either. If he goes on to win 3 Stanley Cups with Chicago, solidifies himself as a Hall of Fame player and always a Hall of Fame person. But, you know, it's you know, to see those things happen. And, you know, that was a magical year, and things really came together because, you know, in February, we were 5 points out of a playoff spot and obviously trending the wrong way, and had to make a coaching decision and, you know, let go of Mike Terry, who did a great job for 2.5 years. And, but again, you know, got lucky, and, you know, so that paid off in 2009, but it was quite the ending.
How do you celebrate as a general manager? How long do you give yourself until you return to work? You have to let it bask. Yeah, you have to bask in the glory for at least a day, Ray.
Oh yeah. That's, I mean, we did it more than that. That's for sure. That was, remember that night, you know, we got back to Pittsburgh and, you know, Mario had the party at his house, and that was pretty incredible. And then the next day I had the cup at my house, because no one really was up, could even stay up to like 1 p.m. Everybody was so exhausted. So I had it at my place, and
exhausted is a good word.
You know,
right?
I think it's exhausting. I still remember because the funny story is that I still remember that you get so many texts from people. Congratulations. Right. And, you know, over the course of 3 or 4 days, I wanted to get back to everybody.
Right.
But then you realize there's like so many guys, people are, fortunately, that's amazing. And it might be like the third day. I remember Gord Miller, TSN, of course, fantastic. So I remember, you know, I texted him, hey, Gord, thanks. I really appreciate it, blah, blah. And I get a text back from Gord, Ray, that's the third time you replied to me. Party on. So I was like, that's fantastic. Yeah. So good old Gord, thanks for the reminder. It was funny. Yeah, we had our cup party down the Cape, down at Steve Rhodes' place, St. Lawrence, you know, his best man at his wedding. And that's where we had it. And that's such a great time. And so many of our St. Lawrence friends were there, obviously. And that was a fun time. So, yeah, so the old St. Lawrence connection came through again. I don't think they even charged me for the venue, which is good.
Well, as a general manager, you know, any way you can save a bit of money is not a bad thing. You had a good run in Pittsburgh.
That's correct.
You won a Stanley Cup. Mm-hmm. The team got to the finals. Great success. What's that feeling like when you're ousted and the team ends up going and winning a couple cups later? Knowing that you still had a hand mm-hmm. in it, you know, do you still feel a sense of ownership even after you've been let go by a team when they go on to success afterwards?
I can only speak for myself, but, you know, it's I was there 8 years and we never missed the playoffs. And actually the 8th year, we had 106 points. That's the most points we ever had. And we ended up losing in the second round in game 7 to the Rangers, 1-0. Some guy Lundqvist shut us out. But that, you know, Rangers went to the finals that year against LA. And, but it was, you know, after 8 years and, you know, with that group, even though the last like 2.5 years really didn't have Crosby, Malkin or Staal together that much. But it was, you know, bittersweet, but as time goes on, they win. And, you know, I got fired in, you know, May of 14. So I think it was 2 years later, they win in 16 and 17 back to back. But I think a lot of that I was really happy about because, you know, it had to be 10 or 12 guys that we had drafted that ended up becoming even more than that, that in terms of like a Sherry as a free agent or Ben Lovejoy as a college free agent. And, you know, guys like Gensel and Scotty Wilson and Matt Murray and Rust, and there's, you know, even, you know, the Brian Dumoulin was in the trade for Jordan Staal. It just, like with anything, is when the team wins like that is a contribution from a lot of different people, including the staff that worked for me. No different than in 09. I say this all the time. A lot of that success goes to Craig Patrick and his staff that, you know, a lot of the, I mean, that's the way it is. And, but again, I think Jimmy Rutherford did a fantastic job there, and really happy for him, a lot of respect for Jimmy. And, you know, I think as time went on, in particular, you know, when you, another opportunity comes along a couple years later with New Jersey, you can, you know, it's, it was really, I was really happy for a lot of the staff that's in Pittsburgh and still there that drafted those kids, that it took time and, you know, for these guys to come along, and but they did. And, you know, certainly Jimmy made some really good moves that really paid off. And but it was happy. And, you know, I think that's to look back at that, and I'm a lot happier that they won. And a lot of the guys that we had drafted and signed or traded for really contributed in a significant way. And for that, you know, I think it helps me or GM or me get another job potentially, which I did in Jersey. But I was really happy for our staff that, you know, it took heat at the same time. As you know, it's not like the NFL or NBA. You draft guys, they jump right into the lineup, or the, you know, there's a position of our cornerback. So it took time, and but I'm happy that it paid off for those guys. And so I guess in the end, I hired a lot of people there that are still there. So I'm very happy for them. And Pittsburgh's a fantastic hockey town and sports town in general. So, you know, in retrospect, I'm really happy and pleased. But, you know, probably when it first happened, I'm like, you got to be kidding me. And then, Jesus. Well, it turned out, I think it was in 16, I think they beat, I think San Jose maybe. Yeah, San Jose. And the next year maybe Nashville. Nashville was bittersweet because I was in Nashville for 8 years. I wanted to see David Poile win a Stanley Cup. Certainly Pekka, guys like that. And, you know, they got close, lost in six games. And but again, I was happy for Pittsburgh. And again, Randy Sexton was there, so that was good. The St. Lawrence connection, getting to damn the cup again. So that paid off.
Winning comes in all shapes and sizes. It's different for you. It's different for me. One thing is certain. Every day, there's an opportunity to win. Just like scratchers from the Virginia Lottery. Every day grab and go, every day giftable, every day fun. The new lucky number scratcher from the Virginia Lottery. 32 chances to win $500,000 plus 4 bonus games. Stop by your closest retailer and check it out. For odds and more information, visit valottery.com.
I think you took one of the hardest jobs in all the sports when you went to New Jersey. And my reason being is that you've had an iconic figure like Lou Lamoriello run the team for so long and create this culture completely unique within hockey. There was nothing like it. To players that grew up in the organization, they're used to it. They know what to expect. To players coming from outside, it can be a complete culture shock. And I have to imagine from the management side, you know what you're getting into, but you don't know until you get there, right? And I'm curious about that early overlap with Lou, finding, you know, really digging in to find out his methods to be able to ingrain yourself in that organization and put your stamp on it, but still have respect to the way Lou had done things for so long there.
Yeah, that's a really that's a really good point, Mike. I knew it wasn't like I had to jump at a job. I mean, I had another year left in my contract with Pittsburgh, but you know, a lot of the was, you know, Josh Harris and David Blitz were the owners, and I was really really keen on what they were about and what they were saying and how they treated Lou. And I was so fortunate that, you know, when Lou was coaching at Providence College when I was at St. Lawrence, played against him, and so I've known him. But even as a GM, you know, it took me probably 5 years to say hi to him, like at a GM meeting. You're so intimidated, Lou. And it turns out what an incredible person. And, you know, I was so fortunate, you know, from David Poile's standpoint, I was the first GM, AGM he ever had. The same thing with Lou Lamoriello, but came in as GM, and, you know, he only stayed out for about maybe 2.5 months before he went to Toronto. But every day I spent with him just asking questions is, why would you do it this way or that way? Or what's your thinking here? And he would ask me the same questions. And he'd raise his eyebrows sometimes at me, and I'd certainly raise them. What? Really? Why would you do that? But it was really great. And it's, I wouldn't take that 2.5 months back for anything. And he's such a, you know, things aren't, but he was the first to say, you know, they never had a father's trip before. They, you know, kids weren't really allowed around in the locker room. I grew up a lot. I think that's such a privilege to, as a kid, to be around the room. And it's certainly, there's a time and place for everything, all of that. And he was so great. And he was just great. Like, there's change here, and you have to do what you do. It's, you're not a rookie doing this. And I'm here for advice and if you have questions or whatever, but you know, don't how I did. And he was, you know, he was new. Someone was uncomfortable for me to change things or do things. And that's just out of circumstance. I think it was after he went to Toronto, because of course Lou at his numbers doesn't, you know, the high numbers and all that stuff. But I think it was Mike Camilleri's, we're in 23, and you know, Mike been in the league a long time. So I let him switch to 13, which no one really wear 13. Now Nico Hischier does, of course, but it was difficult, but so gratifying in retrospect. And then when I was there with Lou, but it was, you know, you mentioned, like, it's, you know, from the outside looking in, you can see how it had a team. That's why, you know, you read, hey, the reporters, they could dissect that team and what's wrong with them, what they should do. Really, like, it's a hard job to be a manager of a team, let alone from the outside looking in. And Lou had all these, as you know, from being around Lou Lamoriello, Mike, is, you know, when he makes it, he would always say, Ray, when I make a trade or a signing, everybody can say it's a good or it doesn't matter. But no one's got the information I have when I make a decision. You know, it's some of those things. And, you know, from the outside looking in, you know, I could read the hockey news and it says, you know, New Jersey prospects are ranked 30th. I know there's only 30 teams in the league at the time. I'm like, okay, well, yeah, that was kind of an uphill battle. But at the same time, you know, over the course of, you know, having a plan with ownership, and we made the playoffs, I think it was the third year, which was kind of a surprise, 97 points, whatever it was. But really, there's a lot of good young players there now. But, you know, it was going to take time. And, you know, making the playoffs, I'm happy we did that third year, 97 points. And it was fantastic to see that building filled. And, you know, rookies that like Jesper Bratt and Nico Hischier, Will Butcher, you know, they're so good for that team and as kids. And, you know, that's what you need. And, you know, that's part of a, you know, foundation to have some success. And, you know, the next year or two, we kind of fell off again. But again, I think they're on their way. And, but it was, you know, it's a tough situation going into. And, you know, I've had two GM jobs, and my predecessor for New Jersey was Lou Lamoriello, and in Pittsburgh was Craig Patrick. I mean, Craig Legends. Won two cups there and Hall of Fame. But yeah, so those are, you know, but again, it's it was incredible having that time with Lou Lamoriello, which, you know, so many people haven't had. And, you know, I'm happy I did take that opportunity, and a lot of good people. And, you know, Tom Fitzgerald is now the GM of New Jersey, and I hired Fitzy back in 07 back in Pittsburgh. And he's done an incredible job. And as I said to him before his first game this year, he's earned every step of the way for himself, no different than he did as a player. So I'm happy for him and excited for his opportunity.
How long did it take players to feel comfortable growing beards, having social media, doing things that have been banned for so long that you had to reprogram them in some ways? I mean, did you legitimately get questions from players in training camp, or were they walking around like zombies thinking, can I grow a beard or not? I don't know.
No, I think right. I think it was so funny. I think, well, there wasn't any beer allowed either. I remember like in the coach's room and stuff. And so, you know, we wanted to change that. And, you know, and I still remember Richie Matthews, a longtime equipment trainer now with great guy. And now with St. Louis. St. Louis won, you know, the three or four cups now. I can't remember, but, you know, I remember asking like in July or August or whatever it was, if you get some beer for the coaches room, they have some meetings, whatever. And he looked at me and like, what? I'm like, yeah, just give me like a beer store out. You get some, and that was, I think Lou was still there. Well, I don't think Mr. Lamoriello liked that. I'm like, well, I don't think he's going to know. Right. So Richie walked away. I mean, I get a call like 45 minutes later. Richie's in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. What? He passed out. Like, what? He passed out. Yeah, they took Richie to the hospital, I swear to God. And, well, Richie was okay, and we got the beer. But that was a shocker for Richie. So, great guy, but, yeah, it was a little bit different. Now, even with the, I think, you know, with, you know, the hair, the beards and things like that. And certainly that was one of the things you mentioned. Like, I didn't want to do things that just nothing was disrespectful at all. And Lou never even would have said anything probably, but obviously he was in Toronto by the time training camp came around. And I think it was Pete Albeats. Pete's the, you know, vice president of PR communications and kind of the go-to for everything. And I remember Pete coming to me, I think before my first training camp in Jersey, kind of saying, because guys are calling him, hey, Pete, like, can we do this? Can we do that? Like, what's the story? And so he's like, the guys want to know, do they have to have their hair cut? Do they have... Like, as long as they're presentable, like, they have beards in the playoffs jersey and they worked three times for him. But, you know, Lou had his way there. But I think it's just about, you know, being professional. And we all know professional is, and it's no different. And Lou, it's Lou's stuff, some of the stuff. And I think, you know, even towards the end with New Jersey, I mean, they had to wear ties all the time when they traveled. And then that got loosened
even
up.
Even the minors like on the bus.
In the minors, really?
Yeah, we'd be on, you know, we'd be in the trash bag on the bus and have to change into the suit.
Really? So that, but that is, you know, and that's, you know, but that is something. And it's, you know, one of the other things that I think was my first year with New Jersey. One of the great things that I experienced was being around Patty Elyash. And I mean, he only played 16 games. That was his final year. And, you know, over the next two or three years, he really, John Hines, who was their head coach, they're now the head coach in Nashville, he was really, Patty was around quite a bit. And, you know, he really was kind of, you know, liked the coaching aspect of it. And he was fantastic for me and John. He could have made life miserable for us. But, you know, looking back there, even for him to experience some of the change, like, he loves Lou Lamoriello, but that to him, he's glad he experienced that because he never played for their team except the Devils. And, you know, for his whole career of, you know, an incredible career and all-time leading scorer for the Devils. And, but again, it's different things. And I'm sure when, you know, when Lou went to Toronto, it was different because, you know, 28 years in New Jersey, he goes to Toronto and we, you know, Brendan Shanahan's there, obviously Kyle Dubas was there, and there's different people that he's working with, which is different. And I'm sure he enjoyed that. And, you know, certainly the Islanders might be a little bit more like New Jersey where he's totally in control, but, you know, he's done a lot for the game. He's done a lot for people, and he certainly did a lot for me.
I was always treated fairly and with respect, and mm-hmm. I value the time I had. They gave me a chance to play in the NHL. It was just a different way of doing things.
Yep.
How quickly did you say deal on the Hall Larson trade?
It was probably pretty quick because it wasn't, I talked to Peter Shirelli before the draft that year, for a couple weeks for the draft. That's where kind of first got started. And when we got to the draft that maybe Wednesday, something like that, you know, I talked to him a few times and all of a sudden we go for the first round on Friday and the second round on Saturday and really nothing. And I was packing my stuff on Saturday, leaving the draft. I went over his table. I said, "Hey, listen, are you going to call me or, you know, don't have anything going here. Just let me know." It was not enough. Sorry about that. He goes, "We're going back to Edmonton tonight or the morning. And I'll call you a couple days." And Peter was great just because, listen, if I'm going to go another direction, I'll let you know. I'm like, great. It wasn't like I was shopping Adam Larson. I liked Adam Larson. But the opportunity with Taylor Hall and he had, Peter had scoured the league. He wanted a right-hand defenseman and preferably under control. And we had signed the previous year out of the 6-year deal. So it was a 24 years old, maybe at the time, and right shot defenseman. And it was a matter of, you know, he wanted more and I said no. And I probably wanted, but I don't know. And it was just what he needed, a signed right-hand defenseman. And Adam, it was good. And I would defend that trade for, and the first year, keep in mind, they made the playoffs in Edmonton, and they lost, I think, in the second round to Anaheim, and Adam was very good for him. And Taylor's first year with us, we stunk, and he wasn't much better. It was the next year we really turned around. That's where Taylor Hall, the MVP season, and you know, certainly was a good trade for New Jersey, and certainly was somewhat a good trade for Edmonton. And but again, it's, you know, the ability to the chance to trade for a kid like Taylor. And I'm happy it took him another year to win the MVP to have that kind of year because I think it would happen right away for him. Wouldn't have been a meaningful because a lot that he had to go through on and off the ice, and he's become a great pro, and I was really happy for him. But big driver of that team that made the playoffs, the 97 points, and he got the MVP, which was fantastic.
First, Ray, I want to thank you so much for giving your time today. Second, if you have advice for somebody that's thinking about management, that's thinking about building a culture, that's even doing this with mites or squirts in hockey, what would you say to that person?
I think with anything, it's got to be fun. I mean, it's got to be fun in pro hockey. It's got to be fun in the American League. It's got to be fun in terms of, you know, if you're the manager of a mite team or a squirt team, like you're a parent, and because USA Hockey revolves around volunteers, and that's you. And certainly, you know, it's a time to, and that's even part of things in the minors with the AHL coaches and things like that. And everybody thought, hey, development for the NHL. Like, how many guys are really going to make it? Really make it? 3-4 guys? I don't know. I mean, well, my a handful. And in terms of, in my thing is, you know, 20 years from now, let's say the coaches in the American League, listen, all these guys are going to make the NHL, and it's not going to make you a failure. But the best thing that could happen to you is in 15, 20 years, you're getting calls from these guys, you see these guys, they've gone to be teachers or lawyers or doctors or anything in their community, and they become successful. And that's part of the expectation. It's not just turning guys into NHL players. And I think that's part of the, you know, building an NHL team. It's really everything in terms of the foundation of your minor league and how you operate down there in terms of your scouting. And I think part of that is also having fun, because it's a serious business, but it's got to have some fun to it too. And you want to work with people and be in the trenches with people, whether it's coaches or staff members or trainers or players, that you want to be in those trenches. It gets hard, but you know, you have each other's and you really care for that. And that's really what you want. It's no different than, you know, we've all had, whether it's baseball or hockey, we know what our great experiences have been. We've all had bad experiences in either the classroom or youth sports, and And we know when we have a good one. It's about the camaraderie. It's about the parents. It's about something special that you remember. And that's so different. But you try to with the culture and the environment for players and coaches, staff, and certainly that makes it a lot more beneficial, I think, for everybody involved.
Big thanks to Ray Shiro for coming on, telling his story from being the son of a Stanley Cup winning coach of the Broad Street Bullies to his championship with the Pittsburgh Penguins in 2009 and on. Fellow Laurentian, an amazing guy. So thanks to Ray Shiro. If you enjoy 6 Degrees, please subscribe and rate in iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to all your podcasts. If you're interested in advertising on 6 Degrees, please contact Believe at BLEAV.com. As always, you can find me, Mike McKenna56, on all the socials. Thanks for listening to 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna.